Well, good morning, everybody. It's a pleasure to be here today. And I was thinking, as we're just listening to the previous comments, you know, for somebody who lives in Minnesota now, Glasgow, Montana, I just do think counts as an international destination for over here. But we were talking a little bit about some production over there, and I'll touch on that in a little bit. But again, I'd like to welcome everybody, and it's definitely a pleasure to be here to be able to speak with you today. When I was given my speaking topic of, kind of what are the big issues that could impact, grain commerce, DDGs, renewable fuels, being a fortune teller isn't really one of my strengths, and so I thought that that could be a pretty short speech. So what I'd like to do today is to talk about some of the bigger issues that we know about, some of the bigger issues that we're thinking about, and then talk a little bit about how my company, CHS, manages those risks. So what if? And the short answer is, it all depends. There's lots of things that are going on in the world right now, and the odds of all of them happening probably aren't high. But if you take a look at these four right here, we know that we're going through a drought, you know, driest that we've had in about 20 years in this country. Crop was much shorter than what we anticipated. Started off very good, got in early, but unfortunately in many areas, and you'll hear some more about that, we didn't get any more rain on the crop. We had some areas that did quite well, and those tend to be our newer production areas, but also traditionally some of our lower yielding areas. But for them, they harvested some record crops. You know, so what if drought were to persist? And we'll talk about that a little bit more. We all know about the issues that EU faces right now economically. You know, we just can't work our way through the debt crisis that exists over there. It continues to persist. Election 2012, the last presidential debate was on television last night. Two somewhat different views of where we're going to go forward, but some of those could have an impact on commerce in this country and how we do business with others. And then, of course, the unrest that we've seen in the Middle East, continuing unrest in Syria, the blockade against or the sanctions against Iran right now, unrest in Libya, some other countries. So my question would be is, you know, what are the odds that all four of these things persist in 2013? And you can form your own assessment. What are the odds that none of these things persist in 2013? You can form your own assessment. Well, what if only one or two of them do? Okay, what's the impact? And I would say the probability is a bell-shaped curve. The odds of none of them persisting are probably low. The odds of all of them persisting are probably low. The odds of one or two of them persisting are probably fairly reasonable. So what that says is we could be in for some pretty interesting times in 2013 as we navigate how we conduct business with our partners. So first of all, what kind of year are we looking at? And I'm very, very thankful that that I've used USDA numbers here since I'm being followed by the chief economist from the USDA. But what's interesting here is if you look at an aggregate soy and corn production, this is the third year in a row that we've actually had a decrease in yield, tonnage. Okay? Now, you know, we know at some point in time we're going to return to trend yields. The question is, when are we going to see that? And obviously the impact that that's going to have on global markets. And interestingly enough, you know, this is the old world, right? Where, basically demand was growing, but average price was declining over time. You know, pretty basic economics. Why was this occurring? Okay. Productivity was increasing faster than demand. But look what happens when we got, you know, past 2000, we started seeing an uptick in price. Why? Demand's growing faster than our output. Now, part of that is the productivity that we have on the acres that we have in production right now. Part of that is the new acres that are coming into corn and soybeans in the United States are coming out of what are traditionally wheat-producing acres, and they just don't have the inherent yield potential that we have in the core markets within the United States. And production in other world areas has kind of come on in fits and starts. A lot of the other world areas tend to be more prone to drought, tend to be more prone to political issues that can disrupt production, and quite frankly don't have the same access to capital that U.S. producers have to be able to expand their output. You know, so that's kind of constrained the growth in output globally, despite the fact that demand continues to rise. As Dave said, you know, we are looking at a planet that's going to have 9 billion people to feed, and as importantly, 9 billion people that just don't want to eat grain. Okay, they want to eat meat. As their incomes rise, okay, they want to quit eating grain and they want to eat animals that ate grain. And depending upon whether it's poultry, a conversion rate of 2 to 1, whether it's swine 3-1, beef 6-1, you know, whatever ratios you want to use, it is going to take a lot more grain to feed an ever-increasing wealthy population on the planet. That's just the math, okay? And everything that we would see would bear that out, that these are the trends that we're going to be looking at over the longer term. So corn exports. You can see continued demand, and it's for the very reason that I mentioned. It's a primary source of animal feed. But what's interesting is you look at that, the U.S.'s share of global exports is going to decline. Not on an absolute tonnage base, but on a relative basis to global production. And so the answer is why? Well, again, we are constrained in this country. We have limited number of increased acres that we can put into corn production. And unless and until we can find some more dramatic breakthroughs in yield enhancements, we're going to see this trend continue. Now, there's lots of technology that's being worked on right now. You know, there's a lot of companies that are dedicated to trying to double the average yield of U.S. production, basically to address the global issues that we've looked at. You know, but that's going to be something that takes time. You know, it's not going to be something that's going to transform U.S. production overnight. But you can see other non-traditional producing areas are going to become more significant exporters of grain beyond the United States. South America, former Soviet Union countries, are all going to have a role to play in helping to feed a hungry world. This is just another graphic representation, and I like it because look at the U.S. share in yellow on the bottom. Okay, we're going to be about half of the total exports of corn in the world. And you can see a lot of these other areas are going to be significant producers as well. And again, as you look at a lot of these other areas, they tend to have more issues associated with drought. You know, we can have some political issues from time to time, particularly in periods of short crop. Okay, we can have grain embargoes where there's restrictions on exports in some of these markets. And what that suggests is that over time, these trade flows and markets are going to become more volatile rather than less volatile. Okay, just by the sheer number of countries that it's going to take in order to get this done. Now, depending upon, you know, how you view challenge, it's either an opportunity or a threat. We see it as an opportunity to try and figure out how we manage that risk and smooth out these supply chains for our customers, and I'll touch on that in some more detail. But we think that that's a core challenge as a supplier of grain to global markets and global customers, is what do we need to do to make sure that we are a consistent, reliable supplier of grain to those customers. Soybeans. You can see what the long-term prospects for exports of oil and meal are versus whole beans. And I'll touch on this a little bit more, but we looked at these trends as well as we looked at what does it take for us to be an important supplier to the global markets. And the domestic market for soybean oil and meals, you know, not growing dramatically, maybe at GDP. But when you look at the export markets, and you say, okay, why is it a soybean market and it's not refined oil and meal? A lot of that's because of the capacity that sits in China. China's got roughly 120 million ton of crush capacity right now, utilizing about 60. Okay, they're going to want beans. They're not going to want oil. Okay, so for us, you know, figuring out what infrastructure logistics it takes for us to be a reliable, consistent supplier of beans to our Chinese customers is something that's very, very important to us. You know, to us, that's more important and adds more value than asking ourselves, you know, what do we need to do to crush more beans domestically? But I think that's a pretty stark trend that we're going to see over time. Wheat exports, some growth, but not nearly as stark as what we think that we're going to see in corn and soy. Why? As we all know, wheat is largely a food crop. Domestic consumption of wheat really isn't growing. There's been some dietary trends that I think have impacted that. Primary uses for food. On the margin, when corn gets quite expensive, it is used for feed. But you can see that we're only expecting moderate growth in wheat relative to what we expect to see in corn and soy. What's really interesting, okay, look at the trend that you see basically for the United States. A continued decline in our supply of wheat to the world. And again, it gets really stark when you look at it with this graphic representation. Again, the United States essentially being in the yellow. We're not growing, okay? Now, what we will export will be high-quality spring wheat and durum, predominantly some soft whites to Asia and some other things like that. But the bottom line is, for many American producers, a lot of American producers, it's far more profitable for them to grow corn and soybeans than it is to grow wheat. Okay? And so those that can substitute are. That's going to push wheat, again, into other areas. I mean, wheat's an arid crop, right? It's the most drought-tolerant, inherently drought-tolerant crop that we can grow. It's going to go to areas that are less suited for corn and soybean production. The real relevant thing for this, for CHS, and it'll give some context to some comments that I'm going to make in a little bit, is if you think about who we are as a Minnesota-based company, we got started in the export business of wheat. That's who we are. Wheat production across the northern tier, Minnesota, North Dakota, Montana. Okay? If we not had expanded our crop range and our regions of origination, if all we did was to export wheat out of the United States, we would be a residual supplier. Okay? And by that I mean we would not be seen as a credible 365-day-a-year supplier of grain to our customers. And the way that I like to think about it is we'd get the last phone call, not the first one. Okay? And that's certainly not how you can base a business on behalf of your owners. So it's been very important for us to be able to stretch our origination globally so we can basically participate in the trends that we see here on behalf of our owners. And it's definitely something that we see as occurring over the longer term. Just for example, and I have to check this, but this is about probably 5 years ago now. Cass County, North Dakota, which is over in the Red River Valley, was the number one producing county in the United States of spring wheat. Okay, about 2 years ago, it was the number one county for soybean production in the United States in terms of planted acres. That's how quickly this has turned. We were visiting earlier, corn being raised in eastern Montana now, under irrigation, but yet farmers have figured out how to grow shorter day-length corn where they have adequate moisture, and a little further east, it's being grown dryland as well. So a very strong trend of conversion, and we think it's only a matter of time before there's more corn acres than wheat acres in the state of North Dakota. Think about that, okay? More corn acres than wheat acres in the state of North Dakota. Who would have ever thought that that was something that we would see in this country? But part of that's being driven by technology. Farmers are figuring out how to get it done, and a lot of that's being driven by demand. The price environment that we see makes it attractive for farmers to take that risk to try and grow that crop. So what if, okay, what if some things were to happen around the world? So what if the drought persists? We've been through one. We looked at 3 years of declining corn yields in the United States. What's that going to do? That's going to put more pressure on global supply. And that will further create a supply-demand imbalance because, you know, the market just can't adjust to a supply shock like that quickly. That would imply prices are going to rise. That would imply substitution of feed where possible. You know, feeders are very, very enterprising. They will figure out how to create the lowest cost ration that they can that meets their nutritional needs. That can create some opportunity in trying to rebalance supply chains for your customers, okay, if you're in the supply side of the business. Food security concerns. We've participated in markets globally where, you know, we have port facilities, and all of a sudden there's no grain to export because the country imposes a ban on exports to preserve that food domestically for food security. And that's happened in the not-too-distant past. That's something we have to be mindful of as we think about trade flows. Farmers, retailers, you know, we're coming off some very strong years financially in the U.S. agricultural sector. And even this year, with the crop that we're looking at, most farmers are in pretty good shape. And a key reason for that is most farmers have crop insurance, okay? And so crop insurance will make up that delta or that loss in revenue that many experience this year, and they'll be well positioned for next year. Quite frankly, with the drought that we're incurring, and we should have this meeting more often because I was actually surprised today to get up and see that it rained a little bit at my house. It's been so dry in this state that it's a surprise actually when it rains. We need the moisture. We need a lot of snow this winter to replenish the soil moisture so that we can have a good crop next year. But one of the impacts that we've had across a lot of the Midwest is typically on corn ground, we fertilize a lot of that ground in the fall. So when it dries out enough in the spring, we can just get in and plant. Okay? It was so dry this fall, we couldn't put a lot of fertilizer on. So that's going to put a lot more pressure to get those acres fertilized in the spring, and a spring in which we see market signals telling farmers to plant more corn. Traditionally in the U.S., you don't use a lot of fertilizer on soy. You do use a lot of nitrogen, phosphorus, potassium, or potash on corn. So that's just something that we're going to have to watch. A wet spring after a dry fall could be a real challenge to get everything done that we need to get done from a work standpoint. So financially, farmers are in a better position to withstand the drought. I wouldn't be too concerned about that. I'd be more worried about the agronomics of farming after a drought. Okay, adequate soil moisture in the fall to get work done. In some areas, we went from dry to wet, and we still have some crop to harvest. You know, it's just going to put a challenge to try and catch up and get back to where we need to be to be successful getting the crop in for next spring. What if the ethanol mandate ends? You're not hearing as much of this as probably we once were. You know, goes away. I think there's some things that we probably need to remember. Number one is ethanol is the most cost-effective oxygen agent that you can put into gasoline. Okay, historically or prior to ethanol, MTBE was used as that additive. It's been banned because of groundwater contamination. So even if the mandate were to go away, we'd need probably at least half of the ethanol that's being produced today just purely as an oxygen agent for clean air standards in vehicles. Okay, so I guess it's difficult for me as I stand here today to see a scenario in which ethanol goes away and the co-products that go along with it, DDGs, many ethanol plants now strip out corn oil on the front side and basically get three value streams off of that ethanol plant versus just one. So, you know, if I were a customer of DDGs, I'd feel reasonably good that that's going to be a long-term supply of protein for feed that I can base my rations on. The rest of it's going to be based upon economics. You know, we've exported some ethanol out of this country from time to time, but the market will adjust to that, I believe, over time. And so, you know, why this is possible, you know, I wouldn't necessarily say that it's probable, and even if it were to happen, we may see a smaller industry than we see today, but the industry I don't believe is going to go away, okay? At least that's how we're basing our business plans right now. Crude oil goes to $150 a barrel. This was done prior to the election in Venezuela. Hugo Chavez was reelected down there, continues to have some health concerns, so, you know, at some point in time, you know, will there be a leadership transition down there? Obviously, the answer is yes, but the question is, when will that occur? And what policies would that create domestically? Quite frankly, I think a bigger short-term risk would be increasing or tightened sanctions on Iran and some form of a blockade in the Strait of Hormuz. That could be quite disruptive to global oil flows. And, you know, it's not the first barrel that prices a commodity like crude oil. It's the last barrel, right? So it wouldn't take much of a contraction in supply to have a significant impact on the price. Well, what impacts would that have? You know, the impacts around the globe, I think, would be rather profound. Price of fuel rises, less money for consumption, something's going to give, you know, just more global unrest, uncertainty that goes along with that. You know, so I think that this is a possibility. Is it probable? I don't know. Is it possible? I think certainly, you know. And we heard a lot of discussion last night in the presidential debate, you know, around foreign policy, and both sides were talking about in some form or fashion, you know, the sanctions that are in place right now economically on Iran. So this is a risk that we have to be mindful of. So, you know, we all know that regardless of who the president is after the election, we have a period of time in what we call in this country a lame duck session of Congress, you know, before there's a turnover of those that were defeated or retired, exited, those that are elected get seated. And what we have to do is we either have to address the tax provisions that are set to expire in this country, which by default would raise pretty much tax rates, you know, not just for the wealthiest Americans, but essentially for all Americans, and the economic impact that would have on our country. The CBO, or Congressional Budget Office, has basically done an analysis that says if that were to occur, the impact on this economy would be fairly dramatic. Okay? Why? Well, if I'm paying more taxes to the federal government, I have less money for consumption. I can't buy stuff. We are a consumption-driven economy. Okay? And our GDP growth is rather meek right now in this country. And the thought is that it's not robust enough to be able to sustain that kind of a tax increase in the short term without going into recession. Now, the impact of that would be obviously it would impact domestic consumption. It'd be quite devastating if that happened at the same time we had an increase in crude oil prices. So at the same time I have less money to spend, the things I spend it on are increasing in cost, right? That's the definition of a bad day. In America, we say that's like falling off the cliff twice, okay? Again, is it going to happen? One would hope that that we'll be able to get together and get this problem solved because I don't think we have to guess what the impact is going to be if we don't get it solved. I think the big issue is just can we politically get it solved within this country? You know, so lots going on, as I said. And, you know, does it all happen? Probably not. Can any of it happen? Probably. You know, I don't know, and I don't know which one, and I don't know that it matters, right? The point is that we have to manage through risk and volatility, okay? That's what we have to do, whether you're on the customer side here today, okay, or whether you're on the supplier side. You know, how you manage that risk collectively in a secure supply chain, counterparty risk, you know, making sure that the consistency of supply at a fair price, may not be the lowest price, but at a fair price, you know, how you mutually secure that, I think is something that's going to be very important. So a little bit about who my company is. We are an agricultural cooperative. We are owned by approximately 60,000 individual American farmers. We're owned by approximately 1,100 farmer cooperatives, local cooperatives in the United States, that would represent about another 300,000 farmers. So collectively, directly and indirectly, we would represent about 350,000 farmers in the United States, farmers, ranchers, cooperatives. We're a diversified company. And so the way that I simplistically think about it is if you take an acre or hectare of land and you think about what it takes for a farmer to produce a crop on that acre, we can literally provide them all the inputs they need to raise that crop. The diesel for their tractor, the fertilizer for the field, the seed, the crop protection products, about whatever they need, we can provide to them. Once they produce that crop, we can market that crop for them. We can either market it directly in the form of grain that we can market. We may further process that into soy, oil, meal, value-added protein products. I'll talk about that in a little bit. We are part of the largest wheat milling company in the United States, so we can add value to that through processing. We're the leading exporter of DDGs out of the United States. We're a leading marketer of ethanol in the United States as well. We don't own ethanol plants, but we have offtake agreements to market those because we are a large refiner of fuel for rural America as well. So the point of all this is through direct ownership in all of these businesses, it is a natural hedge for farmers, right? I can't control what the cost of my inputs are or necessarily what the price of my output is, but I can participate in the profit associated with all of that, okay? So what we do, whether we're selling inputs to farmers or buying the crop back from them, we do it at market-based pricing. We are competitive in the market every day, okay? We take the profits that we generate, we invest that for further growth on behalf of our owners, and then we give the excess profits back to our owners so they have direct economic participation. So an individual farmer, through the company they own, CHS, can compete with any company globally in the grain business or on the input side of the business. And that's a really strong value add that we bring to our owners and the reason why we've been able to be in business for 80 years and hopefully we can be in business for another 80 years. So we are U.S. owned, but we are global, and I'll touch on that a little bit more. We do supply products to over 60 countries around the world, and we have 10,000 employees globally. Majority are in the U.S., but increasingly they're outside of the U.S. as well as we seek to serve our foreign customers. You know, so how do you thrive in a volatile world? And the lens that we look through is what does it take to be relevant, okay? And I look two directions. I look back at my owners. What does it take for me to be relevant to my owners? And I'll touch on that. And as importantly, look out to the marketplace and say, what does it take for me to be relevant to my customers? And so you'll see kind of both ends of that here in a moment. But supply chain logistics, risk management, these are things that are very important to be successful in a world that I think, as I showed you, is going to become, we believe, increasingly volatile. We've been expanding our global footprint. So again, think back to those grain flows that I showed you earlier, corn, beans, wheat. And imagine that we're a supplier of grain to the world, but the only origination we have is in the U.S., particularly in a year where the crop's short, okay? Not a good place to be. If you're going to be a global supplier to customers, they expect that we're going to be able to source globally. And so we've expanded our footprint into the Black Sea, Romania, we have a port, Ukraine, Russia, we have port facilities to pull out of that Black Sea region. We're expanding our presence in Latin America right now. We're building a port facility in Brazil with a partner to pull more grain out of there. We export out of Argentina today. We've opened an office in Winnipeg up in Canada. We just opened an office in Seoul, Korea, Singapore, Paraguay. So we're expanding our ability to originate grain globally, but also position ourselves to support our customers where they reside. And again, a lot of that growth is in Asia, where we see on corn and beans. And, of course, the Middle East continues to be a very strong market for us on the wheat side of the business. One of the things that we're doing on behalf of our owners is expanding our crop nutrients infrastructure. We're sourcing a lot of crop nutrients outside of the United States for our owners. And we're also doing right now a feasibility study to build a large nitrogen production facility on behalf of our owners in the state of North Dakota. Again, linking them to the inputs that they need to be able to build to grow that crop that we can turn around and sell for export for them. Energy, we own two refineries in the United States, one in the state of Montana, one in the state of Kansas. The Kansas one we own three-quarters of right now. We'll be expanding to own all of that. And collectively, we'll put over $1 billion into those refineries to upgrade them and increase capacity to meet the needs of the energy demands of our owners. Okay? We have to make those kind of investments, again, to stay relevant in the energy space on behalf of our owners. Processing and food ingredients, you know, I mentioned that oil and meal were essentially flat domestically. It's largely a whole bean export market. We like the protein concentrate and isolate space. People around the planet are going to want more protein. The focus right now is on animal-based protein, but soy protein is a really nice source as well. So we recently acquired a company called Soul Bar in Israel. Two plants in Israel, one in China, in Ningbo, China. I was just visited last week. Another one in the United States makes soy protein concentrates isolates for value-added products. Okay, again, another way to create value and link that back basically to our owners. So risk management for producers. We also are in the insurance, financing, and hedging business. Okay, so we can provide risk management tools for our producer owners and through our cooperatives as well that help farmers manage that risk of producing that crop, either be it access to capital or access to hedging tools for risk management for forward pricing, and also for insurance, you know, again, to manage against adversity within their operation. So we can provide them the inputs, we can market the output, and we can put a risk management program around that for our producers as well. Do I have a strategy that's going to allow me to not only survive but thrive in an increasingly volatile world? If I'm a supplier and I go away, do my customers care? If as a cooperative, if I go away, do my owners care, right? And the answer is I certainly hope so, because if the answer to that's yes, that means we're adding value to both our customers and to our owners. But if the answer is no, it means somewhere along the way I lost relevance to my customers. I'm not meeting their needs. I'm not providing them the right portfolio of products. If I only have one product and they need four or five, you know, I'm probably not a real value-added supplier. If my owners tell me they need better access to crop nutrients and I can't provide it, they're going to find it somewhere else, okay? And I will lose my relevance to my owners. So that would be my message to everybody in the room, whether you're a customer or whether you're a supplier. You know, what does it take to forge those relationships, you know, that are necessary to create that value, that sustainability, and that relevance to be successful over time? You know, so as I said earlier, you know, with challenge comes either opportunity or comes threat. It just depends upon how you see the world. And at CHS, you know, we like to believe the glass is always half full, and we see it as the opportunity to continue growth on behalf of our owners and to meet the needs of our customers. So with that, I will stop and would love to entertain any questions that you may have.
Gracias. Fernando Lozano, de México. Quisiera preguntarle al expositor, ¿a qué nivel pudiera llegar de destinarse maíz para etanol, para beneficio, para buscar el beneficio para consumo animal o consumo humano. ¿Qué porcentaje podría llegar de la cosecha de maíz en Estados Unidos a etanol?
I'd like to ask the presenter a question. My name is Fernando Lozano, and I come from Mexico. And my question is, what percentage of the U.S. corn crop will go towards ethanol, and then from there as a byproduct for human or animal feed? So what percentage of the U.S. corn crop is going towards ethanol?
Gross basis, the number would be somewhere between 40 to 42% of the U.S. corn crop is involved in ethanol production. But when you produce or you convert that into ethanol, about a third of that is ethanol, about a third of that is DDGs, so you get recovery in feed value there, and about a third of it is carbon dioxide, is basically the rough math on what that production looks like. So the simple way that I would say it, on a gross basis, it's 40%, but a third of that is recovered for value-added animal feed. And that's the other reason why I'm not super pessimistic on ethanol, because you take a bushel of grain and you basically create three products off of it. You create corn oil, you create DDGs, a feed source, and you create ethanol, another source of value. And so I think that's pretty good value-added processing for the product.
Good morning. So, Al-Fasah Al-Morocco. I'm asking some questions. So why did you think in your projection to 2020 that the corn exported quantity will increase, knowing that there are some intention to replace some corn acre by beans? So in your projection, 2020, mm-hmm. you have increased the corn exported quantity. Okay? So we are knowing that there is some intention to replace some corn acre by beans. So, is this true?
Yeah, so let me try it, and if I didn't get it right, please correct me. So, projecting, USDA projections continued export of corn through 2020, and yet some thought that beans will replace corn, and we would see more beans go. So, I have a personal view, and it's my view, okay? The U.S. is naturally advantaged in corn production globally. We grow really, really good corn here relative to other world areas. In fact, despite the drought and the yield environment we're going to have on corn this year, it would still be higher than most of the other world production areas despite a drought. Our average yields on soybeans are on the order of a met ton per acre, okay? And that's really no different than Brazil or Argentina on an average basis. So we are not advantaged in beans relative to those other production areas, but yet our land is considerably more expensive. So we have a natural bias to corn production in this country, and I would say beans are favored more to Latin America, which would sustain higher corn in the U.S. Now that said, every year the market's very good about bidding corn against beans and telling it what it wants farmers to plant. And farmers are very good at adjusting to that. So in 2020, farmers are going to read the market signals, and if it's telling them to plant a lot more corn, they will. But we have a natural bias, I believe, towards corn in the United States. There's one more reason. There's more today in the U.S., farmers rent more land than they own. Okay? Now, if you're going to rent farmland from me, okay, I'm going to price it for corn production. You can raise whatever you want. I don't care. But you're going to pay me corn rent. Now, if you're paying me corn rent, there's a pretty good chance you're going to raise corn, right? So there's another financial bias to raise corn in the United States.
My name is Ayman from Egypt. You were mentioning about the ethanol industry and the DDGs concerning the feed mills. Unfortunately, is it not very helpful for having a DDGs in 26 protein percentage? Is it upcoming industry for helping increasing the protein level of the DDGs, the percentage? The DDG in the existing format, it's 26% protein, and keep using the corn in the methanol, in the ethanol is presenting the DDG but in a low percentage of protein. We are in a processing to find a solution for increasing the percentage of protein to help the feed mills.
Yes. So if I understand the question is, your experience is the protein content of the DDGs that you're buying is declining, which if that's true makes the feed less valuable to you, have to use more to get your inclusion rate. And so is the processing industry looking to increase the protein level of DDGs? Is that the question? Okay. Because unfortunately the answer is going to be much shorter than the question. The answer is I don't know. But I will hook you up with one of our DDG folks who's here today. And please catch me at the break, and I'll let you talk to him, okay?
Good morning. I saw that CHS is going to Brazil. I would like to understand what kind of strategy CHS has to operate there.
Sure. So we've been in Brazil for 10 years. And most recently, we had a 50-50 joint venture in Brazil with Mitsui Company called Multigrain. We exited that joint venture about a year ago. We still have a very strong relationship with Mitsui. In fact, we have another joint venture with them in the food space. But it made sense for both of us to build out our own independent platforms. We're in the south, but increasingly our emphasis is going to be in the growth areas of the northeast part of the country, up around Rondonopolis, where they continue to expand production. And we're partnered on a port facility in Itaqui that'll get built, and that'll be our origination source, export source, basically out of northeast Brazil, because we see that's where a lot of the increased production is going to be. So for us, as we think about our Asian customers and the export demand that I showed you on soybeans, you know, we'll be able to source out of the Pacific Northwest, off the west coast of the United States, out of basically the Center Gulf in Louisiana, out of Costanza in the Black Sea, a little bit out of Odessa in the Ukraine, but not so much. It'd be more Western Black Sea, and then also out of Brazil would be our predominant export sources. So on any given day, we can quote our customers, predominantly in Asia, multiple price sources and origination sources on soy.
Shafei from Egypt. So I have one question, please. Should we expect that a union will be established in the future between the world grain producers?
Between a union established,
yeah.
Between,
yeah.
Which parties?
Between the world grain producers all over the world.
A union established between world grain producers. Well, I suppose anything's possible. I think that's going to be a challenge. Farmers tend to be independent by nature. You need to get them organized in the country, let alone across borders. I think the best way to organize a coalition of producers around the world is to let the free market work and let producers around the world respond to the economics of what the world's telling them to grow, absent a significant amount of government intervention. That's the most likely way that I see to get farmers, given whatever their natural comparative advantages where they farm, you know, let the market tell them what they should be raising and who they should be selling it to.
You told that you are marketing some corn for the farmer, for your farmers. So what are your risk management practices to be with the price volatility?
I'm sorry, risk management practices with whom?
For the price volatility. You know, prices are changing these times for corn, essentially. So how are you doing with what are your practices?
For price management?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, well, for our domestic producers, it's basically providing the hedging tools, with the Chicago Board of Trade. So, you know, they can forward sell their crop if they want to, a portion or, I would say all of it, but a lot won't. So they can basically at least cover the production risk on a portion of their crop. And if they want to speculate on some of it, they can as well. And we also have within our country operations division, we actually have some crop insurance agencies that will help sell crop insurance or revenue insurance so the farmer can manage risk that way as well.